Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear an argument from Relator and Thomas v. Perez.
Okay, please the court, Ms. Karen Lutter and Adam Moore will present argument for petitioner. Ms. Karen Lutter will present the first 10 minutes of argument, and the petitioner will reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Judge Phillips, members of the court, we're here today to argue or to advocate before this court whether or not the United States Postal Service losing a letter constitutes such an abuse of discretion or such a flagrant act that a trial court may essentially strike pleadings of the party. Factually, what had occurred in this case is after the lawsuit was filed, when Judge Harrison was still sitting on the 165th bench, the case was set for trial. And for reasons of scheduling and Judge Harrison's other difficulties, it was very clear that it would not be reached. And co-counsel and I entered into what we have termed a docket control order, but in reality is a Rule 11 agreement because it was never signed by the court, setting up a new schedule and with the consent of the trial coordinator, including in that a trial date and a pretrial conference date. That order or that agreement required that I designate expert witnesses on or before February the 17th of 1993 on behalf of Mr. Thomas. And in fact, on February the 3rd of 1993, I placed in the United States Mail a letter directed to Mr. Swanson stating the name and the address of each individual I intended to call as an expert witness in the trial of the case. I think important for this court's consideration is that prior to that date and subsequent to that date, Mr. Swanson had never tendered any written discovery to the plaintiff. There were no interrogatories, requests for production, or any other documents that would be required under Rule 21A to be served by certified mail, return receipt requested, or filed with the court relating to this information.
Why didn't you send that letter, certified mail? Was that a breach of your normal office practice, or did you draw a distinction between things required and not required?
Judge, I can't answer the question. I can tell you from looking at the letter that during this period, my normal secretary had been ill, and I can tell by looking at the letter that it's not her initials, that she didn't type the letter, because by and large, nothing goes out of the office, and she's been with me for 3 years without going certified mail, return receipt requested, but she was not there, and during that period of time had missed some time, and I had temporary service secretaries in the office. So, you know, beyond that, I have no current recollection of why the letter didn't go. I went back and I looked at my schedule, and I was in trial during that time, so in all likelihood, it was come by the office after court, sign the letter, and walk out the door again. But other than that, you know, I have no explanation besides telling you that it was not my regular secretary who typed the letter. Simply, I can tell by the initials.
You say the letter was lost. Did Mr. Swanson ever say he did not get the letter?
Mr. Swanson presented no sworn testimony, although his pleadings indicate that he did not receive it. I know I mailed it, and I don't want to dispute Mr. Swanson saying that, although I will not concede that.
You say you know you mailed it?
Oh, I know it was mailed, yes, sir.
I think you probably just came by and signed it.
Normally my secretary takes the mail to the post office, the United States Post Office, and it is my usual practice if she is not there for any reason that I do that. Even if I was in trial in Houston, and my guess is, although I don't have any current recollection of signing this particular letter, I know that I had already determined who my experts were going to be on the first trial set, and I had never had any discovery. And before that docket control order kicked in on designation, I had already made that determination. So there was really nothing for me to hide. Had I received written discovery, it would have gone out long before this, but I had never been requested that information. I know that as a matter of course, when my secretary is not there, simply because we have such an early pickup where our office is, that we just take everything downtown because it made it easier, and she lived kind of past the downtown post office. So as a matter of course, on any day when she is not there, I pick up the mail, walk out the door with it, and drop it off at the post office myself. So that's why I'm saying, you know, I have no doubt whatsoever that I did that on this occasion. There's absolutely no reason to believe that it did not go in the mail. It was never returned. It was properly addressed. And Mr. Swanson claims, although he presented no evidence at the hearing, that he did not receive it. Where I fault Mr. Swanson is not bringing that to anyone's attention for months. The docket control order, I placed this in the mail on February the 3rd. Mr. Swanson did not bring it to anybody's attention until a pretrial conference, docket conference on May 14th of 1993, when he for the first time moved to strike the experts.
When that happened, did you consider or did you move to revise the docket control?
I moved for continuance, and interestingly, the normal practice of the district courts in Harris County is when cases are continued, a new docket control order issued. Whether they're continued or whether they do not get reached, in this case, no new docket control order has issued, and then this court stayed the proceeding, and certainly that should this court rule with me, I would, of course, go back in and request that the court enter a new docket control order. Now, Mr. Swanson has had the benefit of knowing who those experts are since May of 1993.
That's true. What I'm curious about is why you didn't move.
I moved to continue the case, Your Honor.
Why you didn't move to revise the docket control order when the agreed order stipulated February 17th?
Well, looking at the case law of this court, it seemed to me that the appropriate procedural step for me was to ask for continuance of the case. And so that was the procedural step that I took at that point in time.
Are you referring to the Alvarado case? Or
I do not recall the name of the case involved. I know that I looked at the issue and looked at the holdings of the court then in effect and determined that to preserve error on the issue that I needed to file a motion for continuance. Judge Ray had in the pretrial conference made it clear that she thought we would go to trial, and so I felt that a motion for continuance was the appropriate step to take on the matter. Essentially what we have, I believe, is an abuse of discretion in three realms. One, clearly, if this is a sanctionable offense at all, then it is a Rule 13 sanction, and it has been held by the courts of this state that the trial court has to show a finding of good cause. And, in fact, there was no testimony, and there is no finding by Judge Ray in this court. And then the next question is whether or not the post office losing the letter is such egregious conduct that my client should effectively be denied a trial on the merits, because this is a legal malpractice case. And as this court has stated multiple times and in the authority cited in our brief, my client cannot prevail without expert testimony. And by striking the experts, it is tantamount to death penalty sanctions in this case with no finding of any cause, and in fact, not even a violation of the order of the court, but in fact, a Postal Service error based upon a Rule 11 agreement.
Was there any evidence offered at the motion to strike on July 19th?
There was no oral evidence. There was a sworn pleading filed by me.
So we have no evidence at all in this mandamus proceeding?
We had the evidence, my under oath testimony as an officer of the court with a sworn pleading, Your Honor, that was filed with the court. Yes, that evidence is before you. There's no evidence from the opposing counsel.
Were there any oral discussions on this subject during the period from January to May 93 between you and opposing counsel?
No, sir. Well, Your Honor, I did speak to Mr. Swanson, I believe, Judge Doggett, after the hearing in May. And
actually, I'm thinking about in the period before May, like at the time the letter was sent or prior to the letter being sent.
There was a court-ordered mediation, at which point in time, or moderated settlement conference through the Houston Bar Association that occurred during this period of time where Mr. Swanson actually appeared, and at that point in time he made no mention of the fact that he had not received the letter, and in fact that aborted very shortly after it began.
Was there any discussion of experts or presentation of what experts would say during that court-ordered mediation?
No, sir.
And there was no discussion orally of who your experts would be prior to your sending the letter in February?
I don't recall. I am pretty sure that at some point in time, and I don't know if I mentioned it to Mr. Swanson or not, I had indicated that I would, of course, call Dr. Jacobs, who was the treating physician of my client, and that Ms. Ball, who had represented the defendant in the underlying case. Those were clearly two people who had relevant information. I do not believe that Mr. Edwards had ever been discussed prior to that time, but I I had, in fact, consulted with him prior to the first trial setting, so he had agreed to be my expert on the case. But the other two were both active participants in the underlying causes that brought about this claim, and should have been, you know, that they were readily apparent as people with knowledge of relevant facts, as well as individuals who had been involved in the underlying claim. The underlying workers' compensation case had been settled, but then there had been a subsequent case in which Ms. Ball had represented the City of Houston, who was the employer of Mr. Thomas at the time he originally sustained his injury.
Good morning, Your Honors.
I would like to discuss the death penalty sanction aspect of this case, basically under this court's holding in Trans-American. Briefly, I'd like to readdress your case, Justice Phillips, regarding why it was not sent certified mail and whether it was necessary to send it certified mail. I think Rule 21 and 21A contemplate certified mail for pleas, pleadings, motions, and other requests from the court. A designation of experts in this case is simply correspondence between the attorneys, and I think the appellate rules contemplate that such correspondence between attorneys need not be sent by certified or facsimile or one of the other methods under 21 or 21A, because they allow for regular mail of appellate pleadings, briefs, notices of appeal, etc. So I think the rules do provide for regular mail and not requiring certification of the mail return receipt requested in all instances.
But is there any instance when you get the benefit of the so-called mailbox rule if you don't send it certified?
Your Honor, I think under the Southland case and then the Cliffy Huggins case, that when an attorney or a person places a properly addressed postage pre-placed envelope in the mail, then they have the benefit of the mailbox rule. The Southland case is a 1952 Court of Commission case adopted by this court, and it specifically did not contemplate or did not address the certified mail, because in that case it was simply a check being sent by an insurance company. And that court held that the presumption of receipt kicks in when they place it in the mail, properly addressed and postage prepaid.
Why wasn't the presumption rebutted when your opposing counsel said you didn't get it?
Your Honor, because opposing counsel offered no evidence to that fact. He didn't verify his pleading, he didn't offer an affidavit, and he offered no sworn testimony, so there's no controverting evidence before Judge Ray. The only evidence before Judge Ray is that it was placed in the mail. The rule specifically provides that if he offers evidence to the contrary, then the presumption is overcome. In this case,
that's by the sworn pleading that Ms. Lerner referred to earlier?
That's correct, Your Honor. The only evidence before this court is Ms. Lerner's pleading that it was properly addressed and placed in the mail. Briefly turning to the sanctions now for the failure to attach a green card or whether 21 or 21A applies. In Transamerica and in its companion case, Braden v. Downey, and then later in the Chrysler Corporation case, v. Blackman, this court has repeatedly stated that the purpose of sanctions is to secure compliance with the rules, deter similar misconduct, and to punish violators.
Is there any difference in the trial court enforcing a sanction which automatically accrues by operation of, say, Rule 215 for the failure to comply with the timetable set out in the rules? Is there any difference between that and your failure to comply or a litigant's failure to comply with the court order?
I don't think that there's a difference. For example, I think I understand your question to mean, for example, the automatic exclusion of 166B regarding designation of experts within 30 days, if there's an interrogatory that's been propounded. I don't think that there's a difference in that instance. However, in this case, again, the only evidence was is that Ms. Lerner had timely designated by placing it in the mail.
Well, can a trial judge, if it's in a hypothetical circumstance, not this case, can a trial judge enforce his or her order by contempt?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to your question. I'll be happy to follow up on the brief about contempt. I think that certainly
you're uncertain whether a trial judge could enforce their order in any way. In other words, there's a question, at least in your mind, whether they could enforce it by contempt, and you're saying they couldn't enforce it under the court's previous writings in Transamerica.
That's correct, Your Honor. I don't think, for purposes of this proceeding, there's a difference between, and I think this addresses your 215 question, I don't think there's a difference in the standard on sanctions for death penalty sanctions between discovery under 215 and a Rule 13 sanction. I think that the purposes of the sanction is to secure compliance, to prevent future misconduct, and to punish violators.
Did I misunderstand there was not a signed docket control order?
I don't believe there was a signed docket control order, Your Honor.
The council had just agreed on...
I think it was an agreed... an agreed order regarding the deadlines for the docket control. But I don't think Judge Wright has signed it. But I think Ms. Lerner may be able to address that better than I am about. I think the standards of Transamerica and Brady v. Downey in the Chrysler case are applicable to this case on death penalty sanctions because it has the same effect. It prevents the plaintiff from adjudicating a trial on the merits. And this court discussed the four factors in Chrysler and said, in finding that the respondent abused its discretion in Chrysler, the court addressed these factors. One, there must be a direct relationship between the conduct and the sanction. The court has repeatedly said that although they can't guarantee the party will be protected from the conduct of their attorney, that the court should at least inquire about whose conduct is being sanctioned. Is it the attorney, the party, or both? In this case, the party was not involved at all. It was a simple mistake on a green card. However, the court immediately issued death penalty sanctions and struck the experts. Additionally, the court said, secondly, that the trial court should not issue an excessive sanction, that the punishment should fit the crime. And I think that this punishment of striking experts and death penalty sanctions is facially excessive, considering once again that the only mistake was a green card was left off of an envelope.
Under Rule 215.5, any time a witness is automatically excluded for failure to comply with the designation requirements of the rule, and it prevents a plaintiff from presenting some evidence on an essential element of their case, that would operate as a death penalty sanction, wouldn't it?
No, I don't believe it would, Your Honor, because there may be other ways that that party could get the same evidence through other witnesses or through interrogatory responses or other discovery that was already confounded.
Well, let's say that the only evidence you had of damages was through a witness who you failed to disclose more than 30 days before trial and for which there was no good cause to allow that testimony. Under your argument, that would be a death penalty sanction for the trial judge to enforce the automatic exclusion under Rule 215.5, wouldn't it?
You're correct, Your Honor, but I think the difference in that instance and this one is that in that instance, the rule specifically states that if you fail to disclose a witness within 30 days of trial, they're automatically excluded. The drafters of the rule intended for persons to not withhold their experts or their witnesses, and if they did so, they wouldn't be allowed to testify. In this case, interrogatories weren't propounded requesting the identities of the experts, and I don't believe that they were within 30 days of trial at the time of the motion to strike.
Or does that afford greater dignity to the operation of Rule 215.5 than it would to a trial court's pretrial order?
I don't understand.
In other words, you're saying Transamerican isn't implicated under exclusion for exclusion of a witness under 215.5, but is when there's a failure, alleged failure to comply with the court's pretrial order requiring designation of expert witnesses, if I understand you correctly.
I think Transamerican discusses in the other sanctions cases discussed Rule 215 specifically. However, I think that Transamerican is not necessarily implicated in those other cases where somebody has failed to designate, because the rule specifically allows the exclusion of experts or witnesses who aren't designated at least 30 days before trial in response to a proper discovery request. So I don't think it's necessary to consider Transamerican and Brady v. Downey when the rule specifically provides for the exclusion.
It's only when there's a court's pretrial order?
No, I think it's only when it's not covered by the rule or it's a death penalty sanction that's not expressly provided for in the rules, and this death penalty sanction is not provided for anywhere in the rules.
There was a continuance, is that correct?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I think what happened is that they were going to put the case to trial and we filed an emergency proceeding in the state.
Another trial knocked us off the docket, Your Honor. It was reset for August. This man then overrode that trial.
I don't think the motion for continuance that Ms. Lerner filed was granted, but we were bounced by another case. Turning back to the Chrysler case, Your Honors, the third court The third factor that this court said the trial court should consider is imposing lesser sanctions first. Is there something else that would promote compliance with the rule? I think that the trial court had several options. For example, she could have ordered Ms. Miner to produce her expert's reports, a monetary fee, a $250 or $500, some kind of sanction that would be directly attributable to the attorney rather than the party, and a lesser sanction, something less than death penalty sanction. I see my time is up, Your Honors.
Any questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Stephen Swanson,
May it please the court, I'm Steve Swanson. I'm here to respond for the respondent. This is a case involving a typical Harris County pretrial order that we see all the time, docket control orders, if you will. In December of 1992, the parties received a letter from the court indicating that they wanted us to confer and enter into an agreed docket control order if at all possible. If we could not agree to the dates, then the court would enter dates for us. I could talk with Ms. Lerner's office. I never talked with her, but with her office, and we came up with some dates, I and her paralegal, some agreed dates for discovery, cutoffs, pretrial orders, and an agreed trial date, with subject to the court's approval. The most important date, of course, was the February 17, 1993 date, which was the designation of experts. And we all agreed to this. In fact, I allowed them to sign my name by permission to the agreed order because we were under the time gun and had to get it filed. It was duly filed, and as Ms. Lerner says, I think probably constitutes a Rule 11 agreement, even if it's not signed by the court. It certainly was signed by the parties and filed as a matter of record, and we had the right to rely on those specific dates. I never received any designation of experts from Ms. Lerner at any point in time prior to the pretrial conference on May 7, 1993. I duly designated my experts on March 17, which was 30 days after the cutoff date that she was to designate hers. I sent mine by certified mail, return receipt requested, as I think is required to do.
And you knew at that time that she had not designated them to you?
To me, she had not. In fact, I made a special trip to the courthouse to see if she had filed some sort of designation with the court. There was nothing on file there.
And you knew at that point, given the nature of the case, that you didn't really need to worry about your experts because her case was over with if she had no experts.
That's the way I felt, Your Honor.
But there was no communication to her of any type at that point.
I felt like it was not my duty to bring to her attention the fact that she had not designated her experts. I assumed she did not intend to call that.
Well, did you assume she just intended to default and drop her case?
I wasn't sure what she intended to do. The case had been dismissed once before, but had been reinstated.
That would be the effect of her not designating experts. It would be just like her non-suiting her case and giving up, wouldn't it?
Correct, Your Honor.
Did every element of her case, or under her pleadings, did it require expert testimony? In other words, I'm thinking, was there a DTPA allegation which might not have required expert testimony?
There were DTPA allegations, but I think in this particular instance, because it is a legal malpractice case, that she could not prevail without testimony from other lawyers regarding the standard of care and the negligent acts which she had alleged. That's the way I understood it. I feel like her case was over at this point in time, but as I said before, the case had been dismissed once before but had been reinstated on the docket. There's been very little discovery done. Frankly, I feel like it was not a serious case that she was willing to pursue. And after not designating her experts, I kind of just decided that this case was probably over. We were ordered to appear before the court on May 7th for a pretrial conference. At that point, at the pretrial conference, and also to hear any other motions that were pending, I filed a motion to exclude the possibility that she might call experts at the last minute. The court did not rule on that motion until July 19th of 1993. The case was called to trial on August the 3rd, but was stayed because of this mandamus petition being filed. We were ready to go to trial, and in fact, I was called by the coordinator saying, be there at 9 o'clock Monday morning, ready to pick a jury. And on that Friday before, this writ was filed, and of course, the case has been stayed ever since. It's my contention, Your Honors, that Rule 21A certainly does control here, that this important designation of experts, and I think is critically important because without them, she cannot prevail in her case, would certainly have been sent by certified mail or fax or something that would show proof of service. I never received any such letter on February the 3rd that she alleges she sent.
Ms. Lerner says that the presumption, the mailbox rule presumption, if it applies, is unrebutted in this record. What's your response to that?
My response, Your Honor, is that in my motion, I made it clear that I did not receive the card. I mean, I did not receive the letter. And as I read Cliff V. Huggins, it states that any time the service is contested, as it most assuredly is in this case, the green card that was returned from the post office should be introduced or produced because the certificate of service creates a rebuttable presumption that the addressee received the letter or the document, the notice, if you will. Such green card was never produced at the hearing. It was never produced after the hearing because one does not exist.
Watson, why did you request the court to exclude expert witnesses if there had not been any designation?
You had
no notice at all that an expert was going to be.
Out of an abundance of caution, Your Honor, I felt like let's don't wait till we get down to the trial date and then I'm going to spring this on the judge at the last minute and say, Judge, oh, by the way, she didn't designate her expert, so I'm filing a motion to exclude now. Because her instructions were clear in the pretrial notice, I want to hear what problems you're having and whether there are any motions out there that need to be ruled upon. So at that point in time, I felt like that's when I needed to file this motion and bring it to the court's attention prior to the actual trial setting itself. The argument that counsel makes concerning Rule 13, the fact that the order is not clear enough and does not set out specific guidelines as far as sanctions, I think is groundless here because it does not apply. Rule 13 only applies for the imposition of sanctions regarding groundless pleadings, and this has no bearing in this particular case. This has nothing to do with pleadings, but simply imposes sanctions in this case because for failing to violate for violating an agreed pretrial order. That's all I have, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Judge Gonzalez, in his opinion in Cliff versus Hudgens, made it absolutely clear that under the factual scenario of this case, this court has already ruled that the presumption is that the documented issue was delivered. Mr. Swanson had the option to present evidence under that decision, and he elected not to do so. It is unrebutted under the case law as set down by this court that there was service. But I think there's some other distinctions that have to be drawn between Rule 15 sanctions and Rule 13 sanctions. If Mr. Swanson had ever sent interrogatories, had ever pounded any discovery, then I would have mandated to have filed that discovery with the court. And I would have been mandated to return it by certified mail, return receipt request. But he never did that. He never, I will agree that this case was dismissed once. It was not dismissed because of want of prosecution. It was dismissed because of a clerical error by the clerk's office. And, in fact, that was pointed out in the motion to reinstate, and there was never even a hearing required on the motion to reinstate.
Counselor, are you saying, now did I understand you to say that because there is evidence, your affidavit that you mailed?
Yes, sir.
And under the case law of this state, it's presumed delivered?
Yes, sir. And the case of Cliff versus Hudgens, and it's cited in my brief and it's a decision by Judge Gonzalez. And Mr. Swanson had the ability and the opportunity at a hearing that was set, an oral hearing set before the court to present any evidence to rebut that presumption, and he presented none, and in fact he admitted it, and he just admitted in this argument that the documented issue was not a pleading as designated under Rule 21A.
Ms. Lerner, do you agree with Mr. Swanson? You had DPPA pleadings.
Yes, sir. I did have some DPPA pleadings in this case. But it was impossible under the factual scenario of this case to make this case without the testimony of Dr. Jacobs, and particularly Dr. Jacobs, who was certainly designated as an expert witness because it related to Mr. Swanson's failure to communicate with the doctor relating to the condition of the client prior to a settlement of the underlying case. There was no way that this case could have been made without the testimony of the doctor, the reliance upon it. Since the doctor had since died, the admission of his records by the custodian of records, and since it is unclear from this court whether or not under that scenario the custodian is an expert or a fact witness, I, under abundance of caution, always designate as an expert witness.
Sometimes it's a little hard in these kinds of proceedings to know what's in the record and what's not, and I appreciate your explanation, your answer to my question, but if you agree that DTPA pleadings against a lawyer in a legal malpractice case don't necessarily require expert testimony?
Legal malpractice, I think that other than statute of limitations, which did not occur in this case, I believe almost always require an expert witness.
Almost always?
Yes, sir. The only instance that I can think of, and since I'm writing a book for West on legal malpractice right now and have been doing an extensive amount of research in the area, and the only scenario that I can find of an expert like this is two scenarios are where there's an appellate decision and it relates to where the one that I have right now where the appellate court decided that the attorney in the underlying case missed the statute of limitations. I don't think I need an expert on that because I already have a decision, and I think that a court can instruct on a statute of limitations case just as a matter of law, and that you would not need an expert to say that the case didn't get filed within 2 years or 4 years or whatever the relevant statute was. But I can think of no other example, nor have I run across any cases that would allow for a finding in a legal malpractice case without having an expert witness to testify. And in particular, this particular case related to judgments of Mr. Swanson made in handling the case and misrepresentations made to the client after he made those judgments. And so in the context of the underlying case, I think there was an intertwining of both the negligence and the DTPA case that would have made it factually impossible for me to prevail at trial without the testimony both of Dr. Jacobs and of Mr. Edwards. And Ms. Ball's testimony was kind of secondary because she filled in. I might also point out to this court this court has promulgated rules relating to doctor control orders. And there is little or no case law in the state relating to those rules, but the rules on their face seem to state that to impose a sanction on a lawyer for the failure to adhere to a docket control order requires that order to be entered in open court after a hearing. Certainly that was not the case here, and it is not usually the case in Harris County when a docket control order is generated by a computer.
What's your citation for that?
Just express language in the rules, Your Honor. I mean, and I will tell you that several of our judges have, in terms of their rulings, expressed that is their opinion also on the rules related to docket control. Or the only last thing I would like to point out to the court is that Judge Ray has violated this court's stay order, and this matter is again set for trial.
Any other questions? Thank you, Senator. That concludes argument in the second call. The court will take another brief recess.